Mark chapter 8 is where we are at tonight, and we are going to be focusing on verses 31 through 37, and we'll get there in just a couple of minutes, but Mark chapter 8 is a fascinating chapter, a lot going on, some things happening with Peter, and we'll see some of that tonight, but these extraordinary things are taking place in the ministry of Jesus at this time. Beginning at verse 1, there was the feeding of the 4,000. That's verses 1 through 10. The disciples were along for that, and they saw Jesus feed the 4,000 with a few loaves of bread and some fish, obviously performing a miracle there and feeding everyone. And then in verses 11 and 12, there was trouble with the Pharisees. The Pharisees came. There's always trouble with the Pharisees. The disciples were there to witness that as they're following Jesus. Beginning at verse 13, Jesus begins to warn down to verse 20 about the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod, about the trouble that they were causing and the danger of believing the way that the Pharisees and Herod did. In verses 23 through 26, there's this wonderful miracle. I love this miracle. It's one of my favorites. It's the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida. And it's fascinating because it's one of two times that Jesus spit. And he spit in this man's eyes. And then he asked him, "What do you see?" And the man said, "I see men like trees walking around." In other words, it wasn't complete. The healing wasn't instantaneous and complete. And so Jesus then, the healing was progressed, and he healed the man completely. So fascinating. Just the thought of Jesus spitting on someone. I spit on people and I get in trouble. At verse 27, we're getting close to the section that we're going to focus on for tonight. But at verse 27, we see Jesus confessing, or rather Peter confessing Jesus as the Christ, as Messiah. In the event that you do not know, Christ is actually not Jesus' last name. That wasn't his last name. The Christ means that he was Messiah, Jesus the Messiah, or Jesus the Christ. We'll read here in verses 27 through 30 to get a running start into the section that we are covering tonight. It says in verse 27, "Now Jesus and his disciples went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi, and on the road he asked his disciples." It is important for us to understand who's there at the moment. You'll notice that in verse 27, it's him and his disciples, and they're on the road, they're heading somewhere, and he asked his disciples. There isn't anyone else around. The throngs of people are not there in this moment. This is more of a private conversation. And he asked his disciples, saying to them, "Who do men say that I am?" So they answered, "John the Baptist, but some say Elijah, and others, one of the prophets." He said to them, this is a wonderful question, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, being the spokesman, of course, for those of you that know Peter. He answered and said to him, "You are the Christ. You are the Messiah." The book of Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, fills in some of the details that Mark did not add in. He said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the Most High." And Jesus actually commends him for that and said, "Blessed are you. And flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but God revealed this to you." Man, God is speaking through you, Peter. That's key for us in just a moment as we get a little bit further. But Peter says, "You are the Christ." And in verse 30, then he strictly warned them that they should tell no one about him. Now, beginning at verse 31 and again down to verse 37, for those of you that take notes, I see two main divisions in these verses. Okay, two main divisions. In verses 31 through 33, we will see what I call the things of men. The things of men. The remaining verses, in verses 34 down to verse 37, we will see the things of God. Two main divisions. Verses 31 through 33, the things of men. And in verses 34 through 37, the things of God. He says in verse 31, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again." He spoke this word openly. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Jesus here again is speaking still privately, and by privately we mean that it was him and his disciples, the 12, perhaps some of the ladies that we know were gathered around helping also, but it was a small group. It was a small group discipleship is what was going on. And Jesus is speaking to them, and we're told there in verse 31 that he began to teach them. He begins to talk about what the rest of the plan is. From this point on, this is what is going to happen. And there's a word here, a key word for you and I, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man, which by the way is a messianic term, and these Jewish men that he was talking to would have understood that when he said the Son of Man, they would have understood that he was calling himself, referring to himself as Messiah, as Savior. And then he says immediately following that, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man, and it's a four-letter word there, and it's must, that he must do these things. Indicating to the disciples, and obviously unbeknownst to them, and we'll see that through Peter's response here, but what Jesus was indicating to them in that small word must was that what was going to take place, and he's going to mention four things, and I'll show you these things in just a moment, but what he was pointing out to them, or what he was about to tell them, was that these things were part of God's plan. The things that he is going to mention, and some of these things are awful things. And yet, what he's indicating to them is that these things were part of God's plan. He says that the Son of Man must do four things. Here's the first one. Suffer many things. Those of us who know about Jesus know that he suffered. We know that he was beaten, that he was tortured, that he was crucified. We know those things. But there were other things beside that, right? He would suffer persecution even before his crucifixion. But he says to them, the Son of Man, referring to himself, must suffer many things. The second thing that the Son of Man must do is to be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes. So he would suffer many things from many people. And he would be rejected by the religious leaders. He would be rejected by the chief priests or the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes. So he would suffer many things. He would be rejected. The third thing that he mentions is that he would be killed. And I happen to believe that it's at this point that Peter kind of checked out. We'll get to that in just a moment. But he says that he would be killed following those things. And then fourthly, the best part, that after 3 days he would rise again. I mean, he says it expressly there that I'm going to die, but 3 days later I'm going to rise from the dead. I'm going to conquer death. But it seems to me that Peter checked out after hearing that Jesus would be killed, that Jesus expected to be killed. Because Peter's response is this in verse 32, and I love it. He spoke this word openly. Jesus spoke to them freely about these things. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Now the thought of it is quite comical for us, that somebody would take Jesus aside. Hey, come on over here. Let me set you straight. Let me give you some info that, you know, obviously you don't understand. You don't know Messiah. I mean, hadn't he just recently answered when Jesus said, "But who do you say I am?" Peter spoke up and said, "Man, you are the Son of God. You're the Messiah. You're the Christ." But now here he is saying, "Jesus, you've got this thing mixed up. You do not understand." And he said to them that then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And again, Matthew tells us that he said, "No, these things cannot be so." What was it that he was rebuking Jesus for? Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. But here's what Jesus did in verse 33. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, I wonder at that point. You know when you get a look You know, those of you that, you know, maybe when you were younger, the adults in here, you may remember your mom or your dad, you know, when they gave you the look. You know, you just knew that you were busted, disgusted, can't be trusted. But even now, those of you that are parents, your kids, you probably have a look for your kids when they ask you something dumb. And there aren't supposed to be any dumb questions, right? But you're a parent. And some of them are dumb questions. And you just look at it, you give them the look, and they just know, oops, went a little too far, said something I shouldn't have, asked something I shouldn't have, whatever it is. But this is hilarious to me because just a short time before this, Jesus is speaking to his disciples, and Peter pipes up, man. He's the spokesman for the group, and he says, hey, you are the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the Savior of the world. You're the Son of God. I know who you are. And he declares it. And then he was commended for that. Jesus said, hey, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because God is speaking through you. And I mean, Peter must have just fell. I mean, he must have been on cloud nine. I know I would be. If Jesus said, man, good job, Chris, I'd feel like, hey, man, there's nothing I can't do. And now here he is, just a short time later, he says that he takes Jesus aside privately and he begins to rebuke him. And verse 33 says, as Peter rebukes him, Jesus doesn't look at Peter, at least not initially. He looks at the disciples. I don't know what Jesus must have been thinking. And, you know, I think it would be offensive for me to say, you know, well, if I was Jesus, you know, but I know that for myself, you know. It's like you look at the rest of the crowd, you just think, this poor guy. And Peter must have in that moment felt like, oh, I was doing so good. Should have just quit while I was on top. Because what Jesus says to him is, get behind me, Satan. That's not a good way to start out, is it? When you're being corrected for something, you know, and they say, hey, get behind me, Satan. And he goes on to say, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. What was it that Peter was upset about? What was it that got to the heart of Peter that caused him to want to rebuke or correct Jesus? Let's look at what Jesus said again. Maybe we'll see it there. And it says in verse 31 that he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, that he must be rejected, that he must be killed, but after 3 days he would rise again. Now, here's why I think that Peter missed the last part of that. I think that Peter, like so many other Jews during that time, they knew that Messiah was coming and they were expecting a conquering Messiah, not a suffering Messiah. Not a Messiah that would suffer and yet at the same time conquer sin and death and then return, not as a lamb but as a lion. Peter didn't understand all of that. He was looking for a conquering Messiah who would come and overthrow the Romans, no doubt, and Peter and the disciples would you know, be part of his, you know, war council. And so Peter misunderstood. Peter was looking for victory, for conquering. And now he hears his leader, his fearless leader, this revolutionary Jesus, say, listen, I've got to suffer, I've got to be rejected, I've got to be killed. I think that if Peter had continued listening to Jesus and heard the last few words here, 3 days, after 3 days, rise again, I think that if Peter would have heard that, he would have at least stopped and said, well, wait a minute, wait, what did you just say, that you're going to be killed, but then you're going to rise again? What was all that about? But you see, he doesn't even go there. That's why I think that Peter must have only heard up until the point that Jesus said that he would be killed. And then for Peter, that was it. He couldn't handle anymore. He didn't get to hear what came after that. I mean, Jesus just shared with his disciples, and obviously Peter being there, the small group that was there, that he was going to cheat death, that he was going to resurrect from the dead, that he would die, but in fact he would rise from the dead and conquer death. I don't think that Peter heard that. Because had he heard that, he may not have done what it is that he did following to rebuke Jesus. I think that what Peter was upset about, I think that there were a couple of things. And Jesus here in verse 33 in his response to Peter characterizes the things that Peter was thinking. Peter tries to rebuke Jesus. Jesus correctly rebukes Peter for a couple of things, I believe. But Jesus, as he rebukes Peter, he categorizes those things as the things of men. You are not mindful of the things of God, but you are mindful of the things of men. You see, he's rebuking Peter for thinking like a man, like mankind. He's rebuking Peter for the mindset that he had. And I think that there are two things. I think that what Peter was concerned with and the things of men, the things that he had his mind on, were two things. I think it can be summed up in these two things: self and success. Strange, isn't it, that after 2,000 years, we're still struggling with those two things: self and success. You see, Peter was expecting Jesus to be a conquering hero, conquering Messiah. But he hears Jesus now talking about suffering and being rejected and ultimately being killed. And Peter cannot fathom, how can you be a conqueror and how can you be victorious if you are suffering and being rejected and being killed? And he didn't understand, because in Peter's mind, like so many other people, like perhaps even many of us here tonight, the chief thought on Peter's mind must have been self, self-preservation, self-promotion. These are things that we still struggle with. The global cosmetic surgery market, the size of it was valued at $49.1 billion in 2020 and is projected to reach $64.88 billion by 2028. With many surgeons offering regular treatment, plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, to people as young as 13. It's an industry. It's a whole world all to itself. Self-preservation. How can I look younger? If I look younger, then I'll feel younger. How can I preserve that? One website estimates the global health and wellness industry, self-preservation, to be worth more than $1.5 trillion and growing. Our society is consumed with being young, looking young, staying young, trying to cheat death as long as we possibly can. My heart has been filled with sorrow over the last couple of years as I've seen people make tremendous changes to their lifestyle because of COVID. Now, I said it from the beginning. I don't want to get sick with anything, COVID or anything else. I hate being sick. You guys hate being sick. But I have seen people so filled with fear. Why? Is it just that they're scared of COVID? Is that it? No, that's not it. But what they are scared of is dying. And why would they be scared of dying? Because they do not know where they are going after they die. But what about self-promotions? Again, something that we still live with. And in fact, Peter, I'm assuming here from what we read, must have been upset with Jesus. Because Jesus was saying, listen, I've got to suffer, I've got to be rejected, I've got to be killed. And Peter's thinking, no, self-preservation, man. This is not the way it's supposed to work. But what about self-promotion? Peter must have been thinking that this is not the way to be a conquering hero, Jesus. But instead, what you need to do is you need to promote yourself. Self-promotion. Facebook remains the most popular social media platform with 2.89 billion monthly active users. TikTok has grown from 65 million users in 2017 to over a billion in 2021. Of the 5.1 billion active internet users worldwide, 4.2 billion are active social media users. The social networking sites industry is worth $62.5 billion. That was in 2021. The number of social media users among the baby boomer generation has increased by 54%. In the U.S. alone, over 77 million Twitter users. What about it? So what? What is social media? It's self-promotion. It's an opportunity for me to show everyone how great I am, because they all need to know. And they need to know that I'm eating corn and chicken tonight. And they also need to know how great my family is. Look at these beautiful kids. And then you look at it and you go, whoa, I am not double tapping that. It's all about self-promotion. It was hilarious to me during the presidential debates a couple years ago. So many people jumped on Ben Carson. You remember Ben Carson? And they were talking about, oh, he's got this portrait of himself in his house. You know, how can somebody be so vain? And the entire time I was thinking, we all have these mini websites, you know, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, dedicated to our greatness. He's got a picture on his wall. What about all the thousands of pictures that I have of myself on my social media? We're all about self-promotion. That's the world's way of clawing your way to the top and making a name, you know, making a great name for yourself. Self-preservation, self-promotion. But I think that Peter was also rebuking Jesus because of the idea of success, or at least the way to be successful. Jesus didn't understand. Jesus, that's not how you become a conquering hero, by suffering and being rejected and dying. That's not going to work. We are obsessed with success also. The self-improvement industry, estimated at $11.3 billion in 2021 and forecasted to reach $14 billion by 2025. We are obsessed as a society with self-promotion, success, and self-help, self-awareness. It's something that we see as prevalent. In fact, it's normal to us. Peter rebukes Jesus for these things. And what we are going to see in our next section is Peter setting him straight. Beginning at verse 34, we enter into our second of the two main divisions, and that is things of God. I failed to mention, it may have been on the screen, I didn't pay attention, but in verse 31, under that things of men, verse 31, I titled success through suffering. Success through suffering. That will be helpful here in just a moment. But beginning at verse 34 down to verse 37, we see the things of God. We've got an idea of what the things of men are: self-promotion, self-preservation, success. But now Jesus begins to teach on the things of God. And in verse 34 and 35, we'll see what he talks about is salvation through surrender. Verse 34, he says this, "And when he had called the people to himself with his disciples also," you will notice that the audience has changed. When he first spoke to the disciples and to Peter, it was just them. And he says to them, you know, this is what's going to happen, suffering and rejection and dying, but I will rise again. That was to a private group. Now it seems that he's reached some destination and he gathers the people around, you see, because now it is time to begin talking about these things. And he begins to share these things. And here's what he says in verse 34. When he had called the people to himself with his disciples also, he said to them, "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." He goes on to say, "For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet loses his own soul?" And he asked this question, "Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" You see, Jesus here begins to correct the thinking of Peter while at the same time teaching the people about how God does things. And the way that God does things is completely different from the way that people do things, isn't it? Isn't it, church? Those of us that are in here tonight that are saved, which I would assume is the majority of us, we used to think completely opposite of the way that we think now. Isn't that correct? I was talking with Pastor Aaron backstage before coming out and talking about the type of person that I was prior to being saved. I got saved when I was 20 years old. That was 2 years ago. And I got saved when I was 20. What's so funny? I got saved when I was 20 years old and I was going to a junior college at the time. And I was sharing with him that I had taken an anthropology class. And I had failed miserably. And so I needed to retake it, but in between taking that class the first time and retaking it the second time, I got saved. Not because of anthropology. But I got saved. And when I took that same class the second time, I got a B. I hadn't had a B since elementary school. For me, that was like an A++++. Something had happened at the age of 20. You see, at the age of 20, I got saved, and I realized when I got saved that I looked at my life and I had nothing, church. I had nothing. I was not working. At the age of 20, I was not working. I was collecting unemployment checks. Why? Because I didn't feel like working. I was failing my classes at school. I had an old Chevy Impala, 63, low rider, baby, slow and low. Amen. And then I found out that I had gotten my girlfriend pregnant at the time. And my dad had been sharing the gospel with me, and I had been to Calvary Chapel San Bernardino off and on, and you know, I hadn't made a commitment. But I realized in that moment, I need Jesus. And the realization that I've got 20 years to my name with nothing to show for it except failure. And now I had not only ruined my life, but I had ruined this young lady's life, and I was about to ruin this little baby's life. I had nothing. Ashes. That's what I had. I had nothing. And things changed drastically and dramatically. Why? Because prior to that, I was sharing with Pastor Aaron, I was absolutely careless. I did not care about anything. Not a thing. And not anyone. Other than me. And then at that moment, God saved me and things began to change radically and I began to think differently. Christ made all the difference. Christ changed my F into a B. Christ made all the difference. And so many of us in here tonight, when we, prior to getting saved, we thought differently. But then Christ. And he began to change not only the way that we act or live or the way that we talk, but even the way that we think about things. And so Jesus begins to teach the disciples and the people the correct way of thinking, the way that God thinks, the way that God operates. And he says here in verse 34, he says, when he had called the people to himself with his disciples also, he said to them, whoever desires to come after me, here is what must be done. Let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Jesus explains to them, shares with them three things. The first really is a decision that the individual needs to make. What is it that you desire? What do you desire? Jesus says, if you desire to come after me, if you desire to follow me, then what you must do is, you must, number one, deny yourself. Self-denial. Now, we do not like that, do we? We like it in other people. Especially if they're denying themselves so that we can get something. We love our church, we love our David Livingstons and our Corrie Ten Booms, and we love those individuals who are willing to sacrifice and deny themselves and lay it all out on the line, those heroes of the faith. We love the thought of soldiers who are willing to put their lives on the line for us. We love the thought of first responders who are willing to be the first ones to take the heat. It's an honorable thing, self-sacrifice. It's an honorable thing in other people. It's not something that I really desire. And yet, this is the way of God. These are the things of God. That if anybody, Jesus says, wants to come after me, here's what is required. That individual must first, it must begin with denying oneself. Now, is he just talking about self-denial, like, you know, I'm on this diet and, you know, I got to deny my cravings, you know, for Bundt cakes, or I just really need to deny myself this soda? Is that what he's talking about? You know, those things, that can be a good way of thinking and a good way of living, you know, to be healthy is a good thing. However, that's not what Jesus is speaking of. In fact, that type of mindset, well, I just got to deny myself, and I need to, you know, if I deny myself for Jesus, then I'll earn my spot. That is not what Jesus is talking about. When Jesus says that individual must deny himself or herself, he's talking about being all in, church. He is talking about laying your life's plans on the altar. Submitting those things to God. And saying, God, if you desire to use these plans for your glory, let it be. However, God, if you desire to take these plans and completely scrap them, so let it be. When he says that the individual must first deny himself, and I think it's safe to say herself also, himself or herself, when he says that, what he's saying is you need to be all in. You must be willing to surrender it all. It means that my life, once I do that, that my life is no longer my own. That I no longer have a say. You see, and I have found over the years of being a Christian and being involved in ministry, I have found that there is a great mystery surrounding this concept. I have spoken to many Christians over the years who have approached me or come in for counseling, who have said, you know, I've been a Christian for a long time. I got saved when I was in high school at a camp, or I got saved so many years ago, but I just feel like nothing's working out in my life. I feel like I'm not going anywhere. And that might be you tonight. You might feel like nothing's working out for you. You might feel like, I'm a Christian, but I still don't seem to have any direction for my life. I have found that many Christians got saved in the past, but since that day have been playing tug of war with their lives. Playing tug of, unbeknownst to them, they've been playing tug of war with God. You see, so many years ago, they gave their life to the Lord. Remember that? They gave their life to the Lord. But since that day, they have been living as if their life was their own. And for the life of them, they cannot figure out why they are not successful in things and why are things not working out. It is because God, had just like He did in the book of Haggai, has been trying to get your attention all of these years to say, listen, you are living as if your life is your own, but you gave your life to me. You no longer have a life. It's mine. Let me do with it as I please. And so many of us supposedly surrendered our life to the Lord, and I do not doubt your salvation, but many of us have been living as if our life was our own when we gave it away a long time ago. When Jesus says that the individual who wants to come after me, to follow me, must first deny himself, he's talking about being all in. I got to lay it all out there. Now, for me, at the age of 20, church, not a problem. I didn't have anything. Yeah, you can have it all. It's a pile of ashes. But I gave those to God, my pile of ashes. And then I began to see God work and to breathe life into those dead bones, and those things begin to rise, and life, he made life out of nothing, church, out of nothing. But perhaps it was different for you. Maybe you had much. Maybe you were successful when you got saved. And it is hard to let those things go. But you see, that is what Jesus is talking about here. He doesn't want half or most. He paid for your life. He bought you. You are His. And that is the first step. That whoever desires, you must first decide what it is that you desire, church. Whoever desires to come after me, if you want to follow me, you must first deny yourself. And then here's the second thing, you must die. You see, when Jesus explained to these people, the disciples being there also, when he said that the individual would need to take up their cross. They were living in a Roman world. Roads that were lined with crosses, with dying individuals on those crosses at any given time. When he said that if you want to follow me, you're going to need to take up your cross and come and die. What he was saying to those disciples and to the people there, they fully and completely understood what he was saying. It would be the equivalent of someone saying, listen, if you want to follow me, you need to go get your electric chair, or you need to go get your firing range, or you need to go get your noose, or you need to go get your gas chamber. Come and die. When he said to them, listen, anybody that wants to come after me, you must deny yourself and come and die. They understood exactly what he was saying. They had vivid pictures. Perhaps even some of them, their loved ones had died on a cross. Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and die. Give it all away. That is the call of Christ. Those are the things of God. Not the things of man. The things of man are self-preservation, self-promotion, success. The things of God, denial and death. And there may be some in here tonight who say, why would I do that? I'm not a Christian. Why would I do that? Well, he tells you why in verse 35. For whoever desires to save his life, whoever is into self-preservation will lose it. If you are consumed with preserving your life, you will find that you will die filled with regret for having never really lived. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. The tighter that we hold on to our lives, the more out of control they become. That is why you and I gave our lives to Christ in the first place. Because we were attempting to live our lives the way that we wanted to live our lives, and we were filled with emptiness, with discouragement, with grief, with regret. Remember that? And so we traded all of that in, and we found life. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. You know, death is not the goal of God. Death is simply the way to get there. It's our Catholic friends say in Latin, via crucis, via lucis, the way of the cross, the way of light. Death is not the goal. Salvation is life. But the way to get those things is through denial, is through death, as we follow Christ. And then he asked this question, and this is a question that I have asked my own kids for years. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? What will it profit an individual to gain all that the world has to offer, but in the process lose his own soul? I am old enough to remember, just old enough, to remember the lead singer of Nirvana, Kurt Cobain. And I can remember loving his music, and then hearing about his death. He was at the top of his game, as they say. All eyes on him. He had everything that this world could offer him. But it wasn't enough, was it? He took his own life. He had exchanged, he had gotten much, gained much, but in the process he had exchanged his own soul. He was filled with emptiness, and there are dozens and even hundreds more of celebrities. Robin Williams and so many others, musicians and who have taken their own lives because they had it all, but realized it was emptiness. They had exchanged their soul. Jesus says, listen, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? What is worth your soul? The goal is to save our lives. He says that in verse 33, that those who lose their lives for his sake in the Gospels will find out that they've saved their lives. That's the goal. But the way to do that, the way to salvation, is through surrender. And as we close, I speak to the church first, to the Christians that are here tonight. Because it may be that you gave your life to the Lord at some point in the past, but you feel as if you've been fighting all of this time. And why am I not getting direction from God? And why do I seem to be floundering? Well, perhaps it is because you are making your own direction. And perhaps you did not fully understand. Maybe it's not your fault. Maybe the individual that led you to the Lord did not explain this. That when you give your life to the Lord, you are giving your life to the Lord, meaning it is not yours anymore. From now on, from this point, you do as He wills, not as you will. And it may be tonight that you as a Christian, you need to, from your own heart right now, make a recommitment to say, Lord, I did not understand. I saw men like trees moving. It's kind of blurry. Until this moment, God, I did not understand what I was doing and how I was living. But now I see. And it may be tonight that from your own seat there that you need to make a recommitment to the Lord to say, God, I'm sorry, please forgive me. I did not realize, and my life is yours. I lay it all on the altar tonight. It's yours. You may have it. But it may be that you are here tonight and you are not a Christian. Maybe your crazy Christian friend or family member brought you, wanting you to get saved. And perhaps for the first time tonight, you realize what has been lacking in your life. What has gone wrong in your life? What has gone wrong is that you've been in control, which is the reason why you are out of control. Because in reality, you have no control. And it may be tonight that you need to surrender your life to the Lord for the first time. And I will offer to lead you in a very simple prayer to do that before we close, but you must understand that God is not looking for most. He is looking for all. You must understand that if tonight you surrender your life to Him, you must understand that you've surrendered your life to Him. That you came in possession of your own life, but if you surrender your life to Him tonight, you will walk out with no ownership over your own life. It is His. But if you do that, you will actually save your life. Right now, you're losing your life. And so I would encourage you and challenge you, trade in the worry and the fear and the guilt and the anxiety and the sleepless nights. Trade it in tonight for joy and love and peace. Give it away to Him. He has never lost a life. Give it away to Him. And you will find that your heart is finally full.